we're going to reconvene the House or the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee. I apologize. Representative Lowe has brought her friend, who's that is not Representative Shetterly Panting.
I think it's a steam train down the track. So.
We're a very relaxed group here during the interim, so we're going to go ahead and get underway with our next panel, and that would be Bob Jundiff from the Oregon Advocacy Center and Philip Chadsey from NAMI of Oregon. And if you two would come forward. You are under now the situation, however. Please go ahead and be seated. If Representative Lowe doesn't like your testimony, she can simply say, sick 'em. So, I mean, that is the problem.
More funding for assistance animals.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh.
Chair Minnis and Chair Williams, my name is Bob Jundiff. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. And I believe that I'm here to give some perspectives on the mental health system from the advocate point of view. And I've handed out to you some written testimony, which violates my rule of going over one page. But since this is the interim, I thought that maybe I could get away with providing 3 pages of information. What I've done is to outline in the first 2 pages some information that comes from national reports. And I think it's important just to set those out because they set out some national concerns about mental health, and they show a couple of things, I think. And one thing that it shows is that this is a national problem. We're not alone here in Oregon dealing with these issues. And the second is that I think that the policy that's driving our mental health system is actually a pretty sound one, and I think that it is consistent with the best practices that are occurring nationally. So why do we still have a problem? And that's one issue that's before us. And the second one, I think, is what can we do about it under the present circumstances, the present fiscal circumstances? That's what I get to on page 3, because I think there are some things that we can do that are not fiscally dramatic, shall we say, and could have some positive effect in terms of what this body can do. I break down my recommendations into 2 categories, one under the category of prevention and access, and one under the category of quality. The thesis that I present to you is that if people are in crisis who have mental health problems, they're going to end up in institutional settings. And it'll either be a mental hospital or it'll be a jail or a prison or some other setting that's available to take them. And our best efforts, I believe, should be in trying to prevent that crisis from occurring in the first place. For a population that we've been talking about today that's a fairly narrow one and one made up of individuals who in many cases are identified or should be identified in the school setting when they're young or in the public health setting or even in the justice system setting that folks can and do get identified. And many of the stories that you hear about problems that occur are people who have been identified. Folks in their communities know about them. They've had problems in the past, and the question is, what can we do? And that's where I believe that an emphasis on prevention, and not prevention of mental illness so much, although I believe that that the science shows that work can be done in that area and be effective, but certainly prevention of crisis. And that means having a mental health system that's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that's doing active outreach into the community and providing the types of supports for individuals that will keep them from going into crisis. I think when you heard from Dr. Davidson earlier, that's what Multnomah County is doing. at long last. And I think it's a very positive development, and it's one that we should watch carefully and learn from. Number two is parity. I'm not, having heard what you said earlier about this, I'm not going to preach to the choir, but I firmly believe that if you're dedicated to the idea of improving mental health services in Oregon and preventing unnecessary crisis, that you should be supporting parity. I think it's absolutely essential to making that happen. I know it's a tough political fight, and there may be limitations that need to be put on it, but I think that without parity, we're just not going to be able to do it. The third point has to do with co-pays for Medicaid-supported services, Oregon Health Plan services. The whole idea we've been talking about is encouraging people to come into services, to break down the barriers for them to come into services, to develop trust for the services. And frankly, if you have a person who's getting an SSI check and impoverished and marginal in terms of maintaining housing, maintaining supports, maintaining family relationships, to make them come up with a $3 or $5 copay is incredibly counterproductive. And I think that if you have an opportunity to affect that, this is one that I don't think you have to be a wizard to figure out that it's penny wise and pound foolish to go down the copay route for psych meds. We should also be encouraging and supporting efforts by the state to maximize Medicaid funding wherever they can. It is a shame that we've become so dependent on Medicaid funding, but that's the reality, and the more that we can do to bring in Medicaid dollars, such as how OMAP's been working to expand the Oregon Health Plan to bring in more Medicaid dollars, that can help support additional services.
Senator Duncan.
You may have talked about this earlier, and it may have happened in the morning when Senator Burdick and I had to be out for a while, but something was said that caught my attention on the Medicaid, that if you're in an institution, Medicaid does not kick in. I heard something about that this morning. What, if you're institutionalized, no Medicaid access, right?
That's true for adults, so 18 to 65.
Okay, but if they're in a home care or in a group home, would they? A community-based, they would qualify.
That's correct.
For Medicaid, but not while they're institutionalized.
Okay. Right.
Assuming that the state's responsibility while they're institutionalized, I assume.
And number five on this list, the one point that I will veer away from my esteemed colleagues who sit next to me, is that I believe that expanding civil commitment is not the answer. It's one that is within the jurisdiction of this committee to look at, and we have for the last three or four sessions. But I believe that it's, first of all, I don't think that affecting or widening the net into civil commitment will ultimately get you what you want, get you where you want to get, because either it expands the allocation of scarce resources into institutional settings and retards the development of the types of crisis prevention services that I've been talking about, just because there's only so much money to go around and there is not Medicaid money for those hospital beds, so we can't maximize those funds. But also, it has a counterproductive effect for many who bounce in and out of those services. And again, my experience, I've testified before this committee before, is that I have found in the 20 years that I've followed mental health services and the commitment process that system triages according to how much money they have and how many resources that they have. And I believe the national statistics bear out that regardless of what the commitment law says, the number of people who go to the hospital and the length of stay that they have there is dependent upon the resources that are allocated to institutional care rather than the nature of the particular law involved. My last portion may look like a rah-rah for all of our bills, and in a sense it is, but it allows me to tie into, it might help to explain why we have, why the Advocacy Center is promoting these particular pieces of legislation and how they tie into the principles that I've been discussing. And some of these bills you've seen before because they came through the process in the last session. One bill would expand the types of complaints that a county has to investigate about the people it serves. Right now, we have a mandatory abuse reporting and investigation system for folks with mental illness, developmental disabilities. It is narrow. It is the most narrow of all of the abuse reporting investigation laws in the state. We have other laws for people in nursing homes and seniors and children. This is narrowed only to abuse. What we've been attempted last session, we'll be attempting again, is to make the case that it's wise to widen that slightly to include neglect, so that people who are languishing and in risk of serious harm because of that, they're not actively being hit with something, but their health and safety is at critical risk because they're not getting the care that they need. And the this ties back into what the idea that if we're going to be more attentive to crisis prevention, that we have to make sure that people who are languishing are going to get a minimum amount of attention from the system that they have been assigned to for mental health services. Number two is this one actually has money attached to it. I know that that's always difficult, but this is a concept that came out of the mental health work group in the last interim, based upon a study from Australia that showed that peer support, in other words, individuals who have been through mental health crisis themselves, when they have an opportunity to hook up with folks who were in that crisis and going through the commitment process, actually can increase the speed of recovery while hospitalized for those individuals and keep them from coming back to the hospital. Many of our counties are experimenting and using peer supports. This would be a program that's designed specifically for folks who are in the state system who come in through commitment. Again, what we're talking about is a pilot project to be limited to one county for a two-year period. We think that it could really on the cheap, because it uses volunteer advocates, have some good results for us that we might want to duplicate down the road. Number three is a bill that would prohibit discrimination against people with disabilities by government entities. Particularly in the mental health area, one of the problems that we as advocates see over and over again are systems of care that refuse to serve people with psych disabilities because they're more difficult to serve at times because of behaviors that could be accommodated with some assistance, perhaps from the local mental health agency or just through some common sense activities, but because there's reasons not to do that. Sometimes it's not easy. Sometimes there's other people that the system is trying to please to just get rid of somebody. It can be an easier course of action. And one of the things that's emphasized in both of these federal reports, if you have the time to wade through them, is that our systems of care can't just jettison people. We can't decide that someone's too difficult to serve and just let them go, because when that happens, you know where they're going to end up, and they're going to end up in the places that you and I don't want them to be. And the fourth is a bill that's coming on top of some litigation that our office has participated in, having to do with the speed with which people are moved from jail settings into hospital settings after they've been found unable to aid and assist criminal defense. Our Bill will be asking that that transfer be made in 7 days so that people who are so disabled mentally that they can't talk to their lawyer, they don't understand that they're in a courtroom, they don't understand that they've been accused of a crime. And that is that standard. It's not an easy one to meet, that people who are that disabled will, in fact, move to hospital care as in a reasonable amount of time.
Other questions for Bob? Okay, why don't we move on to Mr. Chadsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Phil Chadsey. I'm the chairman of the Public Policy Committee of NAMI of Oregon. With me today is Stephen LaWiza, who is our executive director for NAMI of Oregon. I agree with most of what Bob has said today. I don't disagree with any of it except a couple of things. But to reemphasize, I think parity is the key to this. Mentally ill people, the earlier you identify who they are and start treating them, the chances of a recovery are increased many fold. And our system is such that because of mental health coverage is limited in the insurance policies, people don't get identified as early as they can. And when they do get identified, they often don't have the treatment available on a long enough basis to provide treatment for them. They just run out of benefits. And it's particularly important for people who suffer from the severe mental illnesses that we're concerned with, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or manic depressive is the other name for that, and major depression, that they have adequate insurance to cover those treatments early on. Oftentimes, these first manifest themselves in the teenage years, and if you don't have adequate mental coverage in your insurance policy, which people don't in Oregon, you can drive a family into bankruptcy rather rapidly. It only takes about one hospitalization to do that. So that's a major concern of NAMI's. The other, another major concern of NAMI's has been addressed is the number of people that end up in the criminal justice system. And oftentimes they end up in the criminal justice system for rather minor crimes. But if you go to the Multnomah County Jail, the last time I saw any figures on it, was about 18% of the people in the Multnomah County Jail were there have serious mental illnesses. And as Senator Duncan mentioned a minute ago, once you go into the jail system, you lose your SSI, you lose your Oregon Health Plan, and when you come out of jail, those don't automatically start up again. You have to reapply. And by the time you reapply, it's a time, over a time period, you don't have those services, and you need particularly medication to stay out of jail. And it just doesn't work well if you've lost those benefits. Also, from the state standpoint, once you lose those benefits, of course, the burden is up on either the county, or if they go into the Oregon State Hospital or the Oregon State Penitentiary, it's upon the state. So we're talking about a real fiscal impact on the state of Oregon when people lose their SSI and their Oregon Health Plan. We're also very enthused about Multnomah County's using assertive community treatment for the mentally ill. For too long, the people who were getting the treatment were those that were well enough to go and seek out treatment. Now they're taking treatment to the most seriously mentally ill people, oftentimes that are the people on the streets and all. So that's a step, a major step forward. The thing I think that Bob and I do disagree on is I would like to see the civil commitment law expanded to cover the gravely disabled, so that it doesn't cover just the people who are in danger to themselves or others, which is a major criteria, but also those people who basically are so disabled they don't understand they need treatment, and so that there's the ability to treat them if they don't have the ability to form an informed consent to on their own to get treatment. And I would do it. I think it's not a matter of putting them in an institution. The way to do that is to broaden the outpatient involuntary treatment so that it's basically somebody in a black robe can tell somebody that you need to get into treatment and stay in treatment so that you're not a problem either to the public or to yourself because you can't take care of yourself. Copays, I also agree with Bob on that, that even a small copay is such a disincentive to somebody that's only trying to live on $400 or $500 a month that we shouldn't do anything that would discourage people from taking their medication and seeking treatment. So to the extent that copays are being considered, and I know they are as of January, we would oppose that.
Phil, could I interrupt just for a second? Let me just add something to the copay. My name's
yourself for the
thank
record.
You very much. My name's Stephen Loiza, and I'm executive director of NAMI Oregon. And I'd just like to add something to that copay situation. Many of our people are on what is termed cocktails, and there are various medications to help control the mental illness. And I know several people that are on 9 or 10 or 12 different medications. And if you multiply that out by the number of prescriptions that they have, it really is a burden for our people. The other point I want to make is that the copays for children and adolescents and senior citizens were discontinued. They were supposed to go into effect in September, put off until January 1st. The only folks that are left on there that have to pay for copays are people with mental illness, the adults. And it seems to me that is very discriminatory.
There were several bills introduced in the last session of the legislature that we would ask that they be reintroduced this time. One of them is House Bill 2394 that had to do with the allows the investigator in a civil commitment proceeding access to the law enforcement data system. And as I recall, that died in this committee last time. Another bill that I think died in the committee had to do with the modifying the term of civil commitment from one from basically 6 months to 1 year. And again, we would support that. Another one that was introduced last time modified the definition of the mentally ill person for a civil commitment law. That was along the terms I mentioned a minute ago of expanding the definition to include the gravely disabled. So all of those bills we would hope would be introduced this next time and pass out of committee and be passed by the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for either Bob or Mr. Chadsey or Stephen?
One question.
Mr. Chair.
Is there any chance that you guys might agree on something on the civil commitment issue before session? That was the issue, it seems to me, mm-hmm. last session was when you have two fairly influential groups, you know, not agreeing on this point, it makes it very hard, I think, for legislators to come to a reasonable decision. Because it's a very complex area of the law, and two groups are not agreeing, it makes it much more complex.
Let me say this, that a number of states have changed their civil commitment law in the last few years to broaden it to include involuntary outpatient treatment on along the lines that we would like. But I think there's a very strong movement that to oppose that. And it comes out of the civil rights movement of the 1960s, basically. And but the state of California recently changed their law, and several other states have changed their law to broaden it the way we'd like to have it broadened.
Chairman, this is a tough issue, and as you see, we sit here and agree on 90 to 95% of the matters that we're talking about, and I think it's unfortunate that so much attention gets paid to this particular item because, in fact, I think it doesn't matter that much. I think what it does send a signal. Oregon, for example, does have outpatient commitment, which is being bitterly fought by mental health consumer and advocacy groups across the country, and we've had that for years. In terms of looking at this particular law, the things that I've been reading lately about this have, I would disagree a little bit with Phil in that this isn't just those wild 1960s coming back. What I understand is that there is a cost, a human cost to institutionalization, forced institutionalization. That forced institutionalization can at times be traumatic for an individual. That can turn them against the treatment system because they feel that the treatment system is coercive and doesn't have their best interests at heart. If you heard Dr. Davidson earlier, he talked to this issue and talked about the need of engaging people where they are, where they live, and demonstrating to them that this is something that will benefit them and something that they will want to use. Now, there's absolutely no doubt that there are people that approach is not going to work for, and I would submit that our present commitment system is quite adequate to pick up those group of people who need an intervention.
I'd like to add to that comment, and let me just say from my own personal experience with our own family that the hospital experience is not a good one. But at the same time, there was a point where our family member needed a safe, stable environment to get back on his feet again. And even though the experience was traumatic for him and for us as a family, he thanked me for taking him to the hospital. And I can tell you stories about NAMI family members who have lost loved ones because they could not have access to the hospitals. So it's a very difficult situation. Having said that, I will also agree with Bob that ACT, Assertive Community Treatment, is a way to reach out and catch people, help people, support people before they get to that place where they need to be hospitalized.
Let me, it might be helpful to committee members, and including myself, frankly, who 5 special sessions later and a lot of other issues, I'm trying to remember exactly the bill and the impact that we were having on civil commitment that was being proffered and opposed. Are you able, Bob, in a nutshell, to sort of explain to the committee what the bill did last session that you specifically opposed?
Chair Williams, I think the Civil Commitment Work Group had 7 or 8 bills.
Right. There were a package of bills, but what was the primary?
Oh, gosh.
The bill that dealt with the civil commitment law was House Bill 2400.
Right.
That would have modified the language basically to say, to include the language, behaves in a manner that indicates the person is likely, without supervision or assistance of others, to satisfy the person's need for nourishment, personal or medical care, shelter, or self-protection or safety. It added that as a
right.
separate criteria.
So it expanded the criteria from harm to yourself and others to a more generalized criteria as described by that.
Right. If you're going to decompensate
right.
to the point that your health is endangered, it would allow for civil commitment under that criteria as well.
And what I was trying to recall, I think it was last session, there was also a bill to create a 3-year commitment period or something of that sort, a longer commitment
period. That was a separate bill.
Right. Yeah, I do remember that we had those series of bills that had come out of the work group.
I would add to what Stephen said. I have a son that suffers from schizophrenia, and at the point that he really needed to be in treatment. I had him committed for a period of about 5 days, and he came out, and he still didn't take his medication. And finally, one day, he was out of control, and I called the police, and he hauled off and hit a police officer and was charged then with assaulting a police officer. And it turned out that was probably the best thing that happened, because at that point, his lawyer informed him that basically he wasn't able to assist in his own defense at that point, because he was out of control. And through his lawyer and his sister, they were able to talk him into going back on medication. He went on one of the newer atypical antipsychotics. He'd been on an older one, which he hated. And now that he's been on a newer one, he likes it. He's been on it for 4.5 years, and he's back in college again. So if you have somebody saying to you, you've got to go on medication and stay on it, it makes a difference. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of people out there that are in that situation. I agree assertive community treatment is a wonderful thing, but there's still a group of them out there that even if you tell them that, unless somebody in a black robe tells them that or other person in authority, they won't go back on it.
Further questions for the panel? Representative Shirley.
Well, thanks. Phil, I think, listed off some of the bills from last session that he asked to be reintroduced. We're going to have those introduced as committee bills for further discussion as we go, or what's the chair's intent?
Well, I had not, I'll just be honest, we have not gone over all the committee introduction issues yet. Has anyone submitted those bills for redrafting down to LC to get them? Has there been a submission?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to the best of my knowledge, the answer to that is no. But where they were done last year, they could be done fairly easily.
Sure, sure. Well, I'd encourage you to work with Mr. Taylor. I think this is part of, again, the spectrum of issues that we're going to be talking about as we move through these discussions in the next session. So work with Mr. Taylor, and we'll accommodate requests. Bob, have you gotten your – I noticed you had a list of four bills on your wish list. Have those been submitted already or for drafting?
Yes, and I'd like to thank the Judiciary Committee for –
Accommodating. Okay, good. Well, so we'll see your wish list at bill introduction as well. So, you know, Phil, feel free to work with Mr. Taylor, and if NAMI wants to move some of those bills into the next package for consideration next session, we'll be willing to accommodate you on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything? I thought I saw a hand. Did I see a hand, Senator Duncan?
No, Mr. Chair, I might just comment.
Oh, yeah, feel free.
Well, Steve has been extremely active in Clackamas County and worked with him a lot there. So I'm very pleased to see him in his new role, and I think he'll have a major impact statewide. So I think you'll hear a lot from him, and I know you're going to get good things out of him.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Yeah. Imagine that. I wonder if they're here. I think I recognize everybody. Okay. Are they here? I don't even see the witnesses for the next. Saw that.
Technology.
Okay, we're going to take, we're ready to move forward with the next portion of the program, and these are our next witnesses. They'll need a few minutes, obviously, to set up their PowerPoint presentation. So, committee, you can, let's take about a 10-minute break. Will that be enough time for you gentlemen to set up? So we'll take a 10-minute break and begin at 2:05. We'll stand and